Hello and welcome to another episode of History Now. Joining me today from Dublin is author and historian and broadcaster Donal Fallon. Donal's here today to talk about the life and tragic death of the playwright and novelist Brendan Behan. He's a person who myself and Donal share a passion for, so I'm really delighted that we're going to get this opportunity to talk about a very, very interesting character of 20th century Ireland. So Donal, you're very welcome to the show, and thank you for coming on the show. You were one of the early guests talking about the 1918 election, but since then, you know, you've went on to great things with Three Castles Burning podcast. I listened to it religiously every week. Out on a walk, I listen to the podcast, and there's a family that keeps popping up in various episodes, and that's the Behan family. Of course, we all know Brendan Behan, but you know what a family, you know, literary playwrights, writers of songs. You know, they feature very heavily in some of your episodes.
Yeah, I live on the border of Crumlin and Kimmage. No one's entirely sure where one ends and the other begins, but this is the place where the Behan family were transplanted to, I suppose, as they saw it, in the 1930s. Dominic Behan famously said that, you know, to hell or to Kimmage, while Brendan said there was no such thing as suburbia, only Siberia. And in this part of Dublin, you know, a lot of people still remember the Behans, especially Kathleen, the mother of all the Behans, and their involvement in kind of local politics, literature and the like. So it's hard to think of a family in 20th century Ireland who are more involved in both political radicalism and the literary movements of the day than the Behans. But it's also difficult to think of a character more so than Brendan Behan, who did so much, but who has perhaps been reduced to a handful of quotations, or sometimes even a very dangerous stereotype, you know, not only a stage Irishman, but a stage Dubliner, a stage Jackeen, who rejected Irish life beyond the canals of Dublin, you know, who gloried in and celebrated alcoholism, who was an unrepentant Irish nationalist. The more we study of Brendan Behan, the more we realise that that just isn't true. Behan is a very complex, very nuanced character. And in such an incredibly short life, and it's remarkably short, Behan dies in his early 40s, he does so much in Dublin, in London, in Paris, in New York. It's a remarkable life, perhaps one of the most remarkable literary lives.
Yeah, and can we talk a bit about his background? Because those things that you've mentioned, the politics, the literature, we can see where all those influences come from. And there's a lot on both sides of the family.
Brendan Behan is a really difficult figure to study, because when you're looking at the early life of Brendan Behan, there are kind of four names in the mix, right? So there's Behan, Kearney, Furlong, English. And you have all of these unique, but very, very different parts of the family tree, if you will, that kind of shape Brendan Behan as a young man. Every one of us, me, you, everyone, we're all products of our family, of our background. But there's another layer to the Behan story, because Kathleen and his mother have been married before. Jack Furlong, 1916 veteran from Belfast, of whom she later recalled, "He was a member of the Irish Volunteers with my brother Padder, and that meant we had everything in common." That was almost enough. So Behan has this mother, Kathleen, who has been previously married to Jack Furlong, 1916 veteran, goes on to marry Stephen Behan, his father. But I think it's probably fair to say, and I think you, another great Behan enthusiast, might agree with me on this, the best biography of Brendan Behan yet, Michael O'Sullivan's, he talks about the mother of Jack Furlong, Kathleen's first husband, as the big influence over the thinking in the family. As a great line in Michael's book, "Granny Furlong's philosophy was that God was good and Lenin wasn't a bad man either." It wasn't a philosophy that her daughter-in-law... So it was a philosophy that her daughter-in-law also professed without reservation. But on the other side of the family, Brendan's father, Stephen Behan, he alleges that he first sees his father when Stephen's imprisoned through the bars of the prison. And that becomes a strong part of the Brendan Behan story, you know, this commitment to republicanism that's there. But Stephen's mother was a tenement landlord, which was extraordinary. And that's the kind of city Dublin was. You know, the great joke in Dublin was that twopence and a halfpenny looked down on tuppence. You know, that even within the working class, there were layers of class, if you will. But that side of the family, Granny English, as she was known, Stephen's mother, I mean, she owned numerous properties in the North Inner City, was quite a significant tenement landlord. And I think what you find with Brendan Behan, a little bit like Sean O'Casey, who was also guilty of doing this, the narrative that they present of their own background isn't entirely true. You know, rather than coming from the worst of the slums of Dublin's inner city, what I think we find with the Behans is there's a kind of tumble downwards. And the same thing happened in the case of Sean O'Casey's family. So the Behans family, the Behans are a landed family, you could say, in one way. It's not great land, not the best properties in Dublin. But there is a history of that on one side of the family. So it's not exactly the very bottom. It's not the worst of the slums in which Behan is raised. But I think it's the radicalism of his mother, Kathleen, his departed mother-in-law. I think that's the side of the family that greatly influences Behan.
Kathleen Behan comes to Belfast for a while, and their two sons, Sean and Rory, they actually take them to the top of Cave Hill, where the United Irishmen made their vow, you know, in a sort of symbolic gesture. It's a really interesting, you know, initiation, and you can see that going on through the rest of the family.
Yeah, absolutely, and that radicalism is very, very strong, that sense of connection. It's interesting too, though, isn't it, that when Behan does achieve remarkable literary success, Belfast just doesn't really feature in that career at all. He never really tours himself and his work in that city. But the Furlongs and the Behans are so intertwined, it's kind of, it becomes quite confusing later on. Alan Simpson, who is the theatre director who puts on the Queerfellow for the first time, he writes about coming out to the Behan house in Crumlin, and you don't really know who's a Behan and who's a Furlong. They just became one kind of big extended family. But certainly the republicanism of the Furlongs in Belfast seems to be a very left-wing republicanism, a very deeply anti-sectarian republicanism, and I think all of that has a real impact on young Behan. Then there's Padder, Kathleen's brother. Of course, Padder Kearney is remembered for writing the national anthem, but he also writes his own version of the Red Flag. Rise, Irish workers, from your knees, fling forth your banner to the breeze. See where its folds are tinged with red. That's blood the Irish workers shed. I mean, this is a remarkable family lineage to have. He had briefly joined the Free State side in the Civil War, but went back to the Republican cause. And Kathleen is just raising her kids on a diet of socialism, of republicanism, but also Shakespeare, Dickens. You know, she brings the kids on walks around Dublin and shows them things like One Merrion Square, where Oscar Wilde was raised, and talks to Brendan and Dominic and the other brothers about Oscar Wilde, about what happened to him. So it's a really politicised environment for a young man to be growing up in terms of Kathleen, but also Granny Furlong and the influence that they're having on his worldview.
And you mentioned there at the beginning, Donald, they were taken from Russell Street when, you know, after the tenements were condemned and, you know, brought out to where you are now out in Kimmage. Can we talk a bit about, you know, the impact that had on the young family?
Well, it was really bad news for people like Granny English, because, you know, Fianna Fáil promised war on the slums. And when Fianna Fáil win that general election in 1932, I think as much as anything in the urban centres, it's the promise to finally deal with the tenement problem that helps bring Fianna Fáil to power. We think about other things, you know, getting rid of the Oath of Allegiance, opening the prisons and letting the IRA back into public life. But I think in inner city Dublin, Fianna Fáil meant tearing down the slums, tearing down the tenements. But the one thing you have in the tenements that you don't have in somewhere like Crumlin or Kimmage in the 1930s is a very strong sense of community. So when you read Kathleen Behan's recollections, she actually talks longingly for the tenements that they'd left behind, because she missed the sense of community. She missed knowing everyone on the street, and she found it quite anonymous and quite distant living somewhere like Crumlin.
So Brendan spends the first few years in Russell Street, then out to Kimmage, and it's not long before he becomes more involved politically. You know, we're talking about he goes to Liverpool under the bombing campaign of 1939, but then a few years later, you know, you've got that really infamous incident out in Glasnevin at the Easter Parade. Can you talk about his journey towards radicalism that way?
The IRA, by the early 1930s, is an organisation that's kind of drifting a little bit aimlessly. They had flirted with left-wing politics, but there had been a Red Scare. You know, the Sarah Ehrlich programme, the IRA had actively flirted with the idea of launching a socialist political platform. And when it was done, the Red Scare was so intense that they almost immediately abandoned socialism. And I think you could say that the IRA of the 1930s, it's an almost anti-politics organisation. Its left wing has drifted off. The question of questions, as far as it's concerned, is the national question. And there's a real fear, I think, from Stephen Behan that his son is getting entangled in this. They write about the fear of being in his bedroom in you know, Kildare Road in Crumlin, messing around with explosives, that they know he's gone from the Fianna into the ranks of the IRA, and there's a real worry what that could entail for him going forward. But Behan's involvement in the IRA bombing campaign in Britain is a really curious thing, because he kind of goes on this one-man mission. Rather than being sanctioned or authorised, he does something he tried to do before. He arrives in Liverpool, and within 10 hours of arriving, he's arrested. I think that says quite a lot about how disastrously bad the IRA bombing campaign in Britain is going. The problem, well, there's numerous problems. One, British state intelligence is all over the IRA in Britain, so it's near impossible to move. And the only way the IRA is able to operate is by bringing over people from Dublin, from Cork, from the like, who are unknown to state intelligence. But Behan doesn't even have the benefit of being sent over by superiors. He's gone of his own volition. I think it tells us a lot about Behan that when he's picked up in Liverpool, he claims that what he tells them in Lime Street Police Station is that my name is Brendan Behan. I came over here to fight for the Irish workers and small farmers republic. So I think the misfortune of Brendan Behan politically is that he wasn't born 10 years earlier, because the battlefield on which he really wanted to fight, I think, was the battlefield of Spain. That socialism that was in him from his mother. Of course, he tried to go to Spain, but was too young to join the international brigades. I think Brendan Behan is probably fighting the wrong man's war when he's picked up as a youngster, a teenager in Liverpool, as part of this disastrous bombing campaign. But that campaign, I think the only way you can sum it up is that it reflects the lack of politics and the lack of direction within the IRA at that moment in time.
He spends the 3 years in Borstal, in there for 18 months, comes out. We'll go back to, you know, the main product of that period, but then goes on and gets involved in a shooting incident with Gardaí at Glasnevin, and goes on the run.
Look, the great tragedy of young Brendan Behan's life is that he ends up in Borstal. But the great fortune of Irish literature is that Brendan Behan ends up in Borstal, because it does, as you say, it produces the masterpiece that we'll get into later on, which is Borstal Boy. But when Behan comes back to Dublin from Borstal in England, I think it's very, very clear that the same problem is still there. You know, Behan had gone to Liverpool of his own volition without sanction from anyone. And as an IRA volunteer back in the Dublin of the 1940s, he seems to operate much the same way. And Cathal Goulding later said to Michael O'Sullivan that his activities lacked direction on his part and guidance from his superiors. So the problem in the relationship, I think, between Behan and the IRA is that he has this great youthful revolutionary zeal for action. And most of what any revolutionary army does is not action. You know, most of it is quite dull stuff. Behan doesn't take well to things like intelligence work that he's asked to do, currying, delivering messages across the city. He didn't join an army to be a courier. You know, he doesn't take well to training because, like most young men, he thinks he knows it all already. And there's a real problem with behaviour in terms of Behan. What happens in Glasnevin Cemetery, Behan later twists this and he tries to turn it into a very good yarn that he was drunk at the time. I don't think he was. I think it was just an out-of-control action of a young revolutionary. 1942, the war is on, or the emergency, as they kind of ludicrously call it in the South. There's real fear, quite rightly, in the Irish state of kind of collaboration between Republicans and Nazi Germany. And what you get basically on the 5th of April 1942, I think you could only call it a desperate act of bravado, as O'Sullivan puts it, where the police, following an IRA commemoration, move in. They want to arrest a number of individuals, not Behan. Now, Behan later claims that he's one of the people they're seeking, but I think they're more senior people in the organisation that they're after. And Behan opens fire on these policemen. Now, the guards aren't shot, nor is Behan, but it's the kind of exchange in which you could have had a dead guard, the kind of thing that IRA men are being hanged for in the emergency years. So, you know, it could have resulted in the death of Brendan Behan had he been arrested on the spot, or had he shot a policeman on the spot, I should say. And it's worth saying the IRA at that time, Martin O'Kane, the great Irish language poet, he joked about how there were three wings to the IRA. There was the pro-German IRA, the anti-German IRA, and Brendan Behan. Behan was once again very much his own man. But I think the door was closed at that point in terms of Brendan being taken seriously as an IRA soldier by his superiors in the IRA. For not the first time, he had acted in a wild streak manner of his own volition.
In that sort of brief period on the run from Glasnevin until he was captured, in Confessions of an Irish Rebel, he talks about going to Belfast to hide out for a while till things cool down. But there's also another thing I want to talk about, and that's his ordinary job, so to speak, as a house painter. What his father did, his grandfather did. He said he was born in a pot. So, you know, that took him all across Ireland, and it took him to not only Belfast to do house painting, but also, you know, the likes of Donaghadee. And there's a very famous thing he talks about where he comes to Donaghadee to paint the lighthouse.
Now you have a young man who is, you know, twice imprisoned. Borstal, more or less, is imprisonment, whatever they may call it, for revolutionary activity, who really struggles, I think, to find, you know, a way of making a living for himself when out of Mountjoy, who is certainly out of favour within the revolutionary milieu of the IRA. So he tries his hand at what his father has done. Stephen Behan's a very distinguished painter, very respected among painters in Dublin. In fact, he's very much an organiser in the union movement around painters. And Behan begins working in that sphere of life. And you mentioned the great anecdotes around Behan as a painter. St. John's Point Lighthouse in County Down. It's worth quoting a little bit of what the man who employs Behan on painting a lighthouse says about him. He describes him as the worst specimen he'd met in 30 years of service, accusing him of showing careless indifference and no respect for property. And he ends his letter with an urgent call for Behan's dismissal before the place is ruined. I think it's very clear that Brendan Behan, just as later shows its way with Dominic, he's not a 9-to-5er. He can't work a 9-to-5 job. He's a bohemian. You know, he envisions himself as someone who, you know, can write, should write, and will write. The problem is, how do you find that literature in what you've been through? So his mind, I think, drifts more towards from revolutionary activity to trying to be a writer of the revolution, to trying to turn the lived experience of Borstal and prison into words.
Yeah, and when he does that, there are two sort of circles of his life that prove to be crucial. And there's a bohemian scene, no matter how small it is, it's still there in Dublin, the late 1940s and into the 50s. And, of course, Paris, where he goes to Paris. How important were those two sort of social circles of his life, so to speak?
Yeah, they're two really distinct cities in very, very different ways, but in some ways kind of similar. And Paris will always be intertwined with Dublin in terms of literary history. It is the city that gave birth to Ulysses. It's the city that sheltered Beckett for so much of his life. But Dublin, post-World War II, post-emergency, it's an interesting place. You have, I suppose, the emergence of a bohemian set around MacDade's public house in particular. A number of former IRA men who've been involved in the bombing campaign are emerging as kind of social figures there. You have the GI Bill, which allows American servicemen to study in Europe after the war. So you have people like Gaynor Crist, who becomes known in Irish literary history as the Gingerman, and J.P. Dunleavy, who writes that story. The traditional doors aren't open. Something like the Abbey Theatre, for example, which is in very conservative hands at this time. They're not going to publish work by a former IRA jailbird like Brendan Behan. But then you have the Pike, a tiny theatre, less than 60 seats, down a laneway in Dublin. They put on the Irish premiere of Waiting for Godot. They put on plays by people like Bertolt Brecht, Tennessee Williams. And when Behan is rejected by the Abbey, the Pike Theatre and Herbert Lane run with The Queer Fellow. So Behan's great breakthrough happens on this tiny little Dublin bohemian stage. And then Paris offers a break, if you will, from the worst aspects of Irish life, censorship, which is very strong here. You know, Behan's early works are pretty much all banned in Ireland, which he finds hilarious. My name is Brendan Behan, I'm the latest of the band, although we're small in number, we're the best band in the land. But as one editor in Paris joked, he said, "We are lucky that their bigotry is our fortune." You know, the Irish ban all these great writers and they escape to Paris to be published. And I think it's the bohemian atmosphere of Paris. It's always the city of Ulysses and Joyce in the mind of a young Dublin writer. It's Shakespeare and Company, which is as much a state of mind as it is a bookshop. And it's a place where everyone who's looking for something is going to Paris because, you know, they think they're the next choice and they're the next Ulysses. So be it Allen Ginsberg, be it William S. Burroughs, Henry Miller, Baldwin, they're all in that milieu of going to Paris to find whatever it is these writers want to find.
Then in the 1950s, mid-1950s, rapid success, and it's a real double-edged sword. So could we talk about, you know, the meteoric rise, but also how America features in this? Because that's really, really important to the Bain story.
This little theatre in Dublin, the Pike, that puts on The Queerfellow is tiny. It has, it's part of an avant-garde network of theatres, so it doesn't even know it at the time. But it's Joan Littlewood in Britain who runs the theatre workshop. She's the partner of Ewan McCall, the folk singer. And you know the old joke, whoever heard of a right-wing folk club? They don't exist. And Ewan McCall and Joan Littlewood are kind of recreating working class British culture. You know, they're putting voices onto stages that have never been heard before. People like Sheila Delaney, you know, a young teenage writer from Salford, A Taste of Honey. And they see the great potential in Behan. And when his work is brought to London and championed by Joan Littlewood, that is very much the beginning, I think, of an international obsession with this writer. And Littlewood later says that when she hears of Behan's passing, his death, she's so angry that she wanted to travel to Dublin just to kick Behan's coffin, because she couldn't think of a better example of wasted talent ever than Behan. So Littlewood propels Brendan into, I suppose, a meteoric rise in the world of theatre. And the door of London opens the door of New York. And you have this incredible moment where Behan has work being performed simultaneously in London and New York City, which is almost unheard of. New York City, Dermot McAvoy has written a lot on Irish America and New York. He has a great line about Brendan. He says, Brendan Behan was an addict. He was addicted to two things, booze and New York City. And together in less than 4 years, they combined to kill him at the ridiculously young age of 41. New York was a city where you could have everything and anyone at any time. And when you walk down to the Chelsea Hotel in New York today, the plaques are still there. Leonard Cohen is commemorated over the door. Dylan Thomas is too. And so is Brendan Behan. And I think just the idea of the city that never sleeps, of the stardom of New York City, that someone like a young Bob Dylan or Henry Miller was following you around through the streets trying to talk to you. Television, which did not yet exist in any meaningful way in Ireland. You know, it would be the 1960s before television arrives on the scene. Behan is someone who can go on television in America and deliver these Behanisms to, you know, just adoring audiences. So the worst thing that can happen to any alcoholic is fame, I think, because everyone wants to buy you a drink. And that is the experience of Brendan Behan in New York City, that he becomes an enormous star, but drowns in the stardom. And I think the latter works of Brendan Behan are not good. And this is a point that isn't made enough, but you end up with these strange little collections. You know, Brendan Behan's New York, Brendan Behan's this, Brendan Behan's that, where essentially he is so beyond sitting down and writing a manuscript that he is just flinging Behanisms at publishers to try and sustain his livelihood.
You mentioned there that The Queerfellow is on in London, it's on in New York at the same time, but following on really quickly from that is Borstal Boy. So he's got a best-selling play, but also got a best-selling book.
Borstal Boy is an absolute masterpiece, and when Behan is criticised for the book, he says something to the effect of, you know, anyone who tells me this book isn't worth living, I would say to them, adolescence is not worth experiencing. You know, he considers it one of the great kind of, himself, he knows it is, one of the great kind of coming of age adolescent stories. But it's a real break with kind of traditional Republican thinking, I suppose, but even within his household, in that it's almost like, it's not a, I regret my time in the IRA, far from it, but it's more an acceptance of the common ground, the working class common ground that he had built with those young English lads in Borstal. And it also has those early hints of Behan's sexuality, which are very, very important too. Like Behan in Paris had published a short story after The Wake, which very much does talk about kind of homosexual urges. But it's in Borstal Boy, I think for the first time, that the general readership, the general public, get a sense of that. And when Borstal Boy is banned on publication, you know, one of the problems with the censorship of Publications Board in Ireland is they don't have to give a reason why they're banning something. So you can publish a book and you find out in the newspaper that your book has been banned, but there's no appeals process. There's no way of finding out why it's been banned. I think it's the kind of homosexual undertones of the book that probably lead to its banning.
So, you know, as you said, the outset there, you know, it's a short life. It packs remarkable, you know, things into that short life. 41 years of age he dies. And, you know, if we take, for example, you know, the theme of the Queer Fellow, it's against capital punishment. One of the last times we see Brandon, perhaps the last time we see him on video, is an interview with RTE on capital punishment, a matter of weeks before his death. It's a haunting clip because he's so far gone.
Yeah, you know what that clip always, it always recalls the last footage of Miles Nicopoulin, Flann O'Brien, which is kind of equally difficult to watch. One of their contemporaries who lived through it all and survived, Anthony Cronin, great poet. Tony Cronin lived because Tony Cronin basically stopped drinking, more or less, but he wrote a memoir, Dead as Doornails, about these men, Kavanagh, Miles Nicopoulin, Behan, and just the descent into the pits of alcoholism is so tragic. But there's another part of Behan at the end of his life that I don't think is talked of enough, which is that he clearly felt a great sense of guilt that he had come from working class Dublin. He had been in the Republican movement, and he was the one who had made fame and success of this. And Rory Furlong tells a really sad anecdote that's worth quoting about Behan at the very end of his life. He says, "I never met Brendan at any time when he didn't give me money, a lot of money then, around that time. And he did this for a lot of people. I know people who would come up to him and they would say, 'We haven't got our electricity bill paid.' Fellas were forever coming to him and he'd say, 'Right, we go down himself with them.' He'd go down himself with them to the ESB and he'd pay the fine there and then." You know, this great generosity of spirit at the end of Behan's life, flinging money at those less fortunate than himself, is one of those things people remember of his time in Dublin. And, you know, the drink bills stacking up that, you know, when Behan was on the premises, no one else put their hand into their pockets. I think that reflects, one, a great sense of guilt, but also, you know, the willingness of people to take advantage of that. Tony Cronin talks about never seeing Behan on his own in the latter days. There were always these hangers-on from bar to bar. But the fact that Behan's graveside oration was delivered by a former Republican comrade, that people like Cathal Goulding, you know, always spoke of Brendan with great affection. Later on, when they make documentaries like A Hungry Feeling, former IRA men talk about Brendan. They talk about him as a very noble person, a very honest person. Though he had that split with the Republican movement, people retain the fondness and appreciation for Behan, which I think says a lot about his character.
I was speaking to my wife a couple of weeks ago talking about this, and we went on a literary tour of Belfast, and they mentioned Brendan Behan on the bus, and there was a lot of, you know, middle-aged ladies behind us. As soon as they mentioned Brendan Behan, they were all, you know, that sigh that your granny would give you, you know, like when you sees you in your communion outfit or something, you know, it was real, that affection. So, Donal, thanks very much for coming on, but I don't want to let this opportunity go without you telling us about your new book.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, so in which Brendan and brothers feature prominently. It's called 40 in Henrietta Street, From Here to Suburbia. And it's really the story of how North Inner City Dublin, Henrietta Street, the streets around it, were transplanted, if you will, into the sprawling wilderness of suburbia. So, yeah, just to end on that point, I think one of the things that's so unique about the Behan family, there's so much written about Dublin between the canals. You know, it has its many, many writers of renown, but they were perhaps the only writers to really engage with suburbia and Dublin beyond that. So I think that's a real part of Behan's legacy, and he's very fondly remembered in this part of Dublin.
Donal, thanks very much. And for our viewers out there, just listen to Donal's podcast, Three Castles Burning. Fantastic show. Thanks very much.
Excellent. Lovely.